I'd like to make four points in this talk today, and the first one is that it's not just gypsum. Rarely, when we look at soils that have soluble salts or anything soluble in it, rarely is gypsum found alone without a lot of other, or at least one other, salt mineral present. And the only place where I've found this to not be the case is where gypsum is the parent material, and this is a good example in El Papalote, Mexico, where this soil is a petrogypsic and it's forming on a salt diapir. And there's pretty much just gypsum minerals there, a few silicate minerals that are blown in. The second point is that salt minerals are transitory. A single major geomorphic event can initiate the addition or removal of salt from soils, and this will change the taxonomy, how you manage it, the type of vegetation that can grow there, and many other factors. The third point I'd like to make is that salt minerals are active geomorphic agents. Salt weathering, salt heave, and salt corrosion are some of the most expensive urban problems that we face today. And my last point is that salt equals life. In the most extreme environments, salt may be a reservoir of life. So I'll go through these four points. First of all, as we've already mentioned, salt minerals can form in any parent material, and they're most common where there's not enough water to leach them out. And lastly, the salt minerals that you see in these soils can be petogenic, or they can be detrital. They can be washed in, they can be blown in, or they can be part of the parent material. And I think it's really important to determine which they are, because if you don't know, then you can't predict how that soil will behave in the future. So it's not just gypsum. What controls the mineralogy is the chemistry of the soil and what kind of inputs you have. Now, all of these different minerals are going to be controlled by the type of ions that are present in the soil. And what I put up here is just the formula for how gypsum forms, but it can be many, many other minerals as well. And you need to have those ions available. They can come from the original sediment, they can be blown in or washed in, and this is a huge process worldwide. Sea spray is also a huge process for many minerals, not just sulfates, but halite is a big one. If you have sulfide minerals present, you'll get these salts. Volcanic gases and downwind of industrial pollution will also deposit sulfates and other salts. And lastly, atmospheric reactions are well known in the Atacama Desert where we see nitrates, but this happens worldwide. And it just accumulates in soils if they're arid enough to not leach them out. Now, if you start off with a non-salt containing parent material, calcium carbonate and sulfates will follow a distinct morphological trend with time as more and more of that material accumulates. Now, with sulfate, you can have stage one filaments, but more commonly you'll see the stage one snowballs. And as more salt is added to that soil, usually through aeolian processes, but it could be one of any of those seven that I listed, it'll form larger stage two nodules and will eventually indurate and form a petrogypsic or petrosalic horizon. Now with petrogenic sulfates, the snowball morphology, the first stage, they precipitate in these spherical masses. They're 1 to 3 millimeters in width, and they're very characteristic of sulfate minerals. And you can see there are distinct difference of size between these stage one snowballs and the stage two nodules, which I'll show in a few minutes. The minerals that we now know will form this type of morphology are all sulfates, but notice there's all kinds: gypsum, blodite, hexahydrite, oysterite, mirabilite, glauberite, thenardite, barite, and celestine. Now, whether or not this is important depends on what you're using that soil for. Sometimes all you need to do is see that snowball morphology and you know you're dealing with sulfates and you don't really need to know what all of the minerals are. In other cases, you need to know what these minerals are to predict how they're going to behave and how this land will change with global warming or with different changes in land use or urbanization. Here's a stage one sulfate filament, and here's a snowball. Notice the nice sugar-like texture. But notice here's a sugar-like texture, and in the field we identified this as gypsum at first. It looks like gypsum, get it in the lab, and it's not, it's blodite. So sometimes it's really difficult in the field to know that you're dealing with all these other minerals because they can look like gypsum. And here's gypsum snowballs. They look very similar to what I showed before with the blodite. In other cases, they'll have these tabular crystals and be as in these little planar. They still have balls, though. They still sort of accumulate like snowballs. And some more gypsum snowballs. Now, this is a stage one snowball in Jordan, which we again thought was gypsum to begin with. Got it in the lab, and it turns out to be barite. And this is what it looks like under the scanning electron microscope. Beautiful euhedral tabular barite crystals. And again, this is under backscatter, so the white are the barite and the celestine crystals, and then the gray is the basically the silicate minerals that these sulfates formed in. Again, they can also look like filaments. In this case, we have barite filling a root trace. Now, other minerals are often found in these snowballs, but they by themselves do not form snowballs. And you can see the cubes here. This is halite. But most of the minerals in this photo is actually blodite, the sort of massive that's actually forming the snowball. And more halite. We did find fluorite in with sulfate snowballs in Jordan. And then mirabilite, thenardite. And what often happens is they don't make these nice little perfect segregations. It's a very complicated masses of many, many different types of minerals with different sizes of crystals. So very complex systems. Blodite, hexahydrite, blodite in the back, oysterite in the front, more oysterite, glauberite. And so again, it's not just gypsum, and usually it's not just one mineralogy. Instead, it's a mass, a very complicated system of lots of different minerals. Okay, here's the stage two gypsum nodules. As you can see, 5-centimeter scale, much larger than the snowballs. And if you have the salt accumulating in an alluvium in coarse gravel or even coarse sand, the salt will accumulate on the bottom of clasts just like carbonate will. And again, it can be very complicated. You can slice into these pendants and get multiple different layers of different mineralogies, all depending on the dust influx, the chemistry, the change in climate, what's happening to change the chemistry in the soil. And here's a beautiful petrogypsic in Nevada, and Doug Merkler will speak on this in the next talk. But we can also get petrosalic horizons. This is in the Atacama Desert, and this is completely cemented with halite and sodium nitrate. We have to take a saw to try to cut through it, and they're mining this for the nitrates. And we get the same petrosalic horizons in the United States. We see these in California. I couldn't get a good picture for you because our backhoe can't get through it. So how much salt do you have in these soils? Well, it's going to be controlled by inputs and how much time. But petogenic processes can concentrate salt minerals in B or in A horizons in extremely arid conditions. And some of these horizons can be up to 99% salt minerals. This white layer here is 99% thenardite. And this soil started out as just alluvium with absolutely no salt in it to begin with. And the salt has all been added through aeolian and atmospheric processes. Oh, it's going the wrong way. Okay, so the second topic, salt minerals are transitory. If we look at Lower Las Vegas Wash in the 1950s, this was just a dry arroyo, and then the city got built, and more runoff comes from the city, and now this is a river. And it changed the vegetation. We went from just a dry arroyo now to wetlands with wetland vegetation, but as urbanization continued and now we're covering the city with cement and asphalt, we get flash floods. Flash floods have ripped through this soil, and so we went from a very low water table before the city was built to a very high water table as the city was getting larger, and now the water table's dropped again because of the flash floods. And so what's happened is it's completely changed where the salts are in the soil. First, we had very little salt, and it would be fairly deep. And then as the water table was raised, now the salt's precipitating at the surface, and we get a salt crust. And now as the water table gets dropped again because of flash floods, the salt gets flushed out of the surface and back into deeper horizons. And so movement of salt minerals can change the soil classification. These soils were originally mapped as typic aqueous salids, and now it depends on where you go and where the water table is. You can get all sorts of different classifications. The third important point is that salt minerals are active geomorphic agents. A good example is the Las Vegas Valley Water District. Salt corrosion, we also have salt collapse and salt heave, are causing pipe failure rates. We're looking at $2 billion in replacing the piping just in Las Vegas alone. Because of this, worldwide salt corrosion is an enormous problem. It eats away at art and buildings. A lot of this has to do with pollution, air pollution. But we go out in the field. Salts are also beautiful, active, geomorphic agents. All of these rocks have huge cracks in them. If you, I couldn't even brush this off because the boulders, they look good, and you just touch them, and they're full of salt, and they'll just absolutely collapse and fall apart. So salt weathering is really fast. The fourth point is that salt equals life. If you go to a really extreme climate, salt attracts water vapor from the air. It's hygroscopic. And here, this is from the Atacama Desert, and we have gypsum crystals, and we have cyanobacteria that are able to live within these and along these gypsum crystals simply because it can attract the water from the atmosphere. We have algae growing in pedogenic gypsum in Jordan. Here's the SEM. This is the algae, and these are the gypsum crystals. Filamentous cyanobacteria growing with gypsum crystals. And so this has implications for extraterrestrial life. We just published a paper on this where we found the cyanobacteria growing in the surface crust where they can get light, but they're protected from UV, and they're also able to have water because the gypsum attracts water from the atmosphere. We found this in the Atacama and the Jordan and in the Mojave Desert. It's also in the Chihuahuan Desert in Mexico as well. And this is important for Mars because Mars has salt and it's extremely dry, and so maybe we should look for life on Mars where the salt deposits are. Secondly, the cyanobacteria on the surface of these soils, what's it doing for land management? Is this increasing erosion or is it armoring the surface and making the surface more stable? We don't know yet, but that's a good question that we want to chase next. And so, like I mentioned, we go to the Atacama to use it as an analog for Mars. So I think in really extreme environments, maybe salt does equal life. And the buck will stop here. Thank you.
Cyanobacteria, have you measured any nitrogen increases associated with cyanobacteria?
We have not, but they're probably in that layer, that thin couple millimeters. Yeah, we did all the genetic typing so far, but we haven't checked for the nitrogen. It's going to be really high in the Atacama because we have the nitrogen just falling out of the atmosphere there. We have completely cemented soils with nitrates. No, unfortunately in the field I still have a difficult time figuring out which sulfate mineral. I can see the snowball, I know it's a sulfate, but as you can see, they look the same, even with the hand lens. They have that sugary texture, and only rarely do we see the tabular crystals, and those ended up being blodite in that one case, but a lot more work needs to be done. What you can do is you say it's a sulfate, and that at least is a step forward.
I was with Professor John Watson. We observed that this really puffy stuff is probably higher in magnesium than sodium. Have you observed that?
I have a study right now looking at dust emissions in the Salton Sea, and we have not been able to say. We actually were looking at how puffy the surface are, how quickly they will erode, and we do see that mineralogy does control whether or not that surface will be highly emissive or not, but it doesn't seem to be connected with magnesium, at least in that site. What it does have to do with is the crystal habit, and if acicular minerals form, you will have a highly emissive surface. So some of those magnesium, calcium sulfates can be acicular, and so therefore that might be the link you were seeing.
Any more questions? I have one. To sort out at least sodium sulfates from barium, magnesium, calcium, if you could, in the field, tease out some of these snowballs or whatever they might be and run electrical conductivity, could that help you differentiate?
I don't know. They are pretty small and they tend to be really fragile. So how would you get that little 2-millimeter snowball and be able to test it?
Yeah, perhaps that small would be impractical.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
larger, you could tease a number of samples.
Although generally when I see a larger amount of salt, it has all different kinds of minerals in it.
Yeah.
But and what we have to do is we use dental tools to get those snowballs out, to XRD them, to SEM them, because you don't want to run the whole soil or you won't be able to tell what's really in there.
Yeah, that's actually what I was thinking of.
Uh-huh.
Dental tape.
Oh, maybe it's possible. That'd be a good try.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.